you are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment.
That belongs in a museum.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of Treasury Cast, the show that celebrates the greatest comics format of all time, the Treasury Edition, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and joining us this month to talk about Marvel Treasury Edition number 11, the fabulous Fantastic Four, is someone who you've heard on a great number of podcasts over the last couple of years and has been a friend to the network for even longer than that, the awesome Laurel Phillips. Hi, Laurel.
Hi, Rob. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm so glad to finally have a chance to talk to you on one of my podcasts. We've been talking on Twitter for years, and we met very briefly while we were passing each other in line at the Heroes Con 2 years ago. But this is my first chance to talk to you in an extended way, so I'm really happy to have you here.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm very excited.
All right, very cool. So before we talk about the comic, which I mentioned, the Fantastic Four, I want to ask you, what is your familiarity with this format? Did you have them growing up? Do you have them now? Like, what's your history, if you have any, with the Treasury editions?
Well, I don't really. Somebody as a present here just a couple years back bought the Batman Treasury. It's the C25 that you guys covered way back. And I didn't realize this was a thing because it says limited collector's edition. So I just figured it was some oversized Batman comic book. Mm. I had no idea that this was a series of books.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So I just figured it was a one-off kind of thing. So when I heard your show and it's like, oh, wait a minute, I have one of these things.
I mean, do you find like reading the book at that size to be ungainly? Because there are a lot of people who just don't like the book that big. I of course do, but there's some people who just find it just like a pain to read a comic at that size.
No, I really liked it. It's nice to have things all blown up for you. I guess it depends on the art. I mean, if you really hate the art, I suppose right. You wouldn't like it. But I mean, just to sit down for, I don't know, 45 minutes to an hour, is that how long it takes to read one of these things? No, I like that. I like the visual of it. I like the feel of it. You know, it's nice and sturdy. So, no, I really like this thing.
Oh, that's very cool. Good. I'm glad you like it. Well, that's very nice if someone gifted that to you. That's a really cool present because that's a great
book. Yes. Yeah, they got it at, I think, an auction, something like that.
All right. Very cool. All right. Well, we're here to talk about, as I mentioned, the Fantastic Four. And you just mentioned if you like artwork, if you like the artwork you're looking at, you'll love seeing it in the size. And I think this is a great example of that kind of thing, because these are all stories drawn by, of course, Jack Kirby. These reprint four stories from the classic era of the Fantastic Four. This book was on sale August 24th, 1976. Now, when we were talking about what book you wanted to discuss, this was kind of the one you picked out of the list. What are you a big fan of the Fantastic Four in particular? Why did you want to talk about this one?
Oh, I do like the Fantastic Four. I read when I can get my hands on stuff from them. I don't own a whole lot of their stuff, but when I can get it through the library, now online, all kinds of good stuff. I've read enough of it that I figure I've got just enough to be dangerous, if that makes sense.
Okay.
But I've got access to more of the Kirby stuff simply because I know the library has the Masterworks online, through six.
Right.
And so, you know, I was like, man, I used to have the Essential volume myself. So it was like, yeah, this is what I'm more familiar with. And then the later stuff, the more recent, it's going to be like Mark Waid, you know, that era going forward.
Have you been reading comics since you were a kid?
No, okay. I started in college, actually.
Okay.
I was a junior in college.
What is your feeling about Jack Kirby? Because I've mentioned on other shows that when I was a kid, I really didn't like Jack Kirby stuff. I thought it was blocky and weird. And now I look at it, and I'm going to talk about some of the stories in this book. I really love it. Like, I'm in love with it. But I will say it took me a long time to warm up to it.
Well, one of the reasons I thought this one might be fun, I didn't know exactly which issues were in it when we were first choosing it, other than, you know, who it was by. I hadn't looked at the individual issues yet. But it was, I was hoping that some of these issues would have some of his fantastical creations as far as his machines and his doodads and that kind of stuff, because that's where I think he really shines. The imagination of what he puts into those kind of creations, there's an energy there that I get a kick out of. His people, sometimes they're good, sometimes they're bad. It depends. He's got this really funky things he does with the eyebrows that make him a little sinister looking. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so that can be a little off-putting. But other than that, I think he captures people, which is nice. But as we go through this book, you get a variety of, this is going to sound dumb, but Sue's hairstyle keeps up with the times. You know, I appreciate that.
Yeah,
he's paying attention.
Absolutely. That's a minor thing that most probably, specifically male comic book readers, probably would not even pay attention to. But of course, I've never known a woman who's had the same hairstyle for more than a year or two. So that's kind of a big deal. And all good credit to Jack Kirby for paying attention to that.
Exactly.
Yeah. The cover is, of course, by Jack Kirby, and it's just a shot of Dr. Doom, a giant Dr. Doom menacing the Fantastic Four. It's sort of a classic 70s Kirby as Sue is preparing to use her powers. The Thing is punching Dr. Doom's hand. The Human Torch is flying in, and Reed is wrapping his using his stretchy powers to wrap himself around Dr. Doom's hand. So, I mean, this is about as iconic as it gets. I mean, it's the Fantastic Four's biggest villain. Here, literally, with the four characters. What do you think of the cover?
Oh, I like this one. It was one of the reasons I thought, oh, yeah, if we're going to do one of these Fantastic Four, this is a good one because it has such a great cover. And he's doing that big menacing, so the character is much larger, you know, in the background than our characters that are heroes in the foreground. And, yeah, it works.
Yeah, it's with the red background, it's, it definitely would have jumped off the stands when this was on sale. I didn't have this one as a kid. At least I don't remember having it. So this one, but this is, you know, the cover is very, very captivating. So on the inside cover, there is a shot of the four, of the Fantastic Four on the right-hand side of the cover facing off the villains. And I've mentioned on episodes of Fire and Water that I love covers where the heroes are like participating in a social activity, like they're like on a picnic or they're like building a statue. I love all of them. But I also love these covers where you've got the heroes and the villains on either side and they're doing a kind of challenge of the super friend sort of thing where they're just squaring off one by one. I'm a sucker for that format. And that's what you've got here. You've got the Thing with his fist raised, Human Torch, Mr. Fantastic, Invisible Girl facing off against Dr. Doom, Submariner, the Sandman, the prankster, the wizard. Yeah, the wizard, and Pastepot Pete down at the bottom.
Oh, you're not going to give him the dignity of calling him the Trapster?
No, I'm calling him Pastepot. That was his original name, damn it. That's what I'm calling. He went with it. That's what I'm calling him for. So I love this cover because it's just classic superhero stuff.
Definitely. When I first looked at it, though, I thought the Thing, his fist was an extra head because it was so big. Because I was looking, you know, if you count the villains, there's more villains than superheroes.
Right, right.
So I thought, oh, wait a minute, maybe that's another. No, that's his fist. So he counts for two.
All right, fair enough. That's reasonable. So the first story is The Master Plan of Dr. Doom by, of course, Lee and Kirby. It's from Fantastic Four, number 23. Now, I'm going to do a plot synopsis here. I did my best to really shorten this thing, but good Lord, this is a plot-heavy comic, so I will be talking for a little bit. I apologize, everybody, but man, this is one dense story. So following a scolding from Reed about not following his orders, the Thing suggests that they elect a new leader for the Fantastic Four, an idea that is shared by both Johnny and Sue. Meanwhile, a mysterious man watches over the bail hearing for a thieving carnival act who calls himself Yogi Decor. The man pays Yogi's bail and brings him to a warehouse where Decor joins two other criminals, protection racketeer Bull Brogan and handsome Harry Phillips, a con man. They are surprised to see that the man who bailed them out was really a robot. They were gathered by Dr. Doom to be his instruments in destroying the Fantastic Four. Back at a secret hideout, Dr. Doom puts his minions through an experimental process to endow them with powers. Thus, the terrible trio is born. In order to lure the four into a trap, Doom has Yogi pose as a wealthy Maharaja who is gifting the Human Torch with a fireproof automobile. When the Torch finally realizes it's a trap, he is shocked to find that Yogi is an impervious to his flame powers as the car and is felled by knockout gas. The Thing is later attacked by Bull Brogan, who utilizes a device that briefly reverts Ben back to his human form. Without his massive strength, Ben is quickly taken prisoner. At the Baxter Building, Sue is visited by Harry Phillips, posing as a flower delivery boy. He plans to knock her out with his formula and the flowers, but Phillips reveals his intent too soon, and Sue manages to hold her breath and escape by turning invisible. Phillips, however, is able to hear her movements and blast her anyway. Reed is later lured into a trap set by Doom, who uses a robot fashioned after the Thing to send out a Fantastic Four signal flare. Doom then takes Richards back to his hideout. Doom then tricks the Terrible Trio into thinking they are getting paid, but instead of money, the box containing their reward spirits them off to another dimension where Doom can call on them whenever he sees fit. As the Fantastic Four begin to break out of their confinement, Doom attacks them directly, able to hold his own with the various technological gadgets in his armor. But when the Fantastic Four begin gaining the upper hand, Doom seals them in the room, which have been prepared to take advantage of a solar wave that was passing through the Earth that would transport the Fantastic Four into the oblivion of deep space. Realizing what is happening, Reed commands Sue to use her invisible force field to pin Doom to the wall outside, putting him at risk of falling through the portal as well. Not willing to die along with his enemies, Doom opens a window into the room in order to try and disable the trap. This allows the Fantastic Four to pull Dr. Doom into the room. As Doom struggles with the Thing, he falls through the portal and into space. With their enemy seemingly vanquished, Fantastic Four escape through the window to safety. In the aftermath of the battle, the other members of the Fantastic Four realize that Reed is the only one fit to lead them. Whew! Huh. And I didn't even mention the dinosaur in this story.
I was going to say, you skipped a baby dinosaur.
Yeah, this thing opens with a baby dinosaur running amok, which causes the whole argument. So what do you think of this story, Laura?
Well, you know, it's not my favorite Dr. Doom story.
Okay.
There were a couple other ones I think they could have chosen, but come on, it starts with the baby dinosaur. Mm-hmm. How cool was that?
Yeah.
I mean, that was a great cold open. I don't like how Reed is being in this at all. And when I read the comics on either side of this, he wasn't quite this nasty about things, like, you know, scolding them like school children and I have to be the leader around here and all that stuff. I don't know why this particular issue painted him in that light.
He's in a bad mood.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know. The stress was getting to him or something. And then love the android robot thing. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, why hire a flunky when you can just keep building robots?
Right. Yeah. I do love Reed says, it's too bad that my so-called partners don't work as well as Doom's machine. Can't you do anything right? Woo.
Yeah.
He's in a really bad mood. And I love that when the other three decide to vote for the team leader, they all vote each other for themselves as team leader, which is great. They see their notes and they've all voted for a separate thing. Johnny's pretty dumb here in that he falls for this. Hey, you're going to get a free Fantastic Car. All you have to do is show up. And it's like, Johnny, could you think that through at all? Like, maybe this guy's a little suspicious. But no, Johnny just, you know, goes right along with it. So,
yeah, well, you know, and then the traps all involved gizmos that Dr. Doom had to come up with. I'm thinking, why did he even need these people? Because these gizmos are pretty cool. I mean, he's got the flame-proofed, fancy, futuristic car. He's got a beam that'll actually put the Thing back to being human. He's got this, you know, wacky knockout stuff, the glass thing that he puts together to capture Reed. And he has this special ion dust something or another that he coats the room with, so it's going to attract these solar rays. Why not just attack him with that?
Yeah, right, yeah. Doom's kind of missing the forest for the trees. I love the sequence where Reed tests Sue. He's testing her reflexes, and he wraps himself around her. And I love that she's like, he literally says, where she escapes using her powers, and she says, and I'll thank you not to call me dear, Mr. Richards. I'm still angry with you. And then he says, just like a woman. Everything I do for your own good, but you're too scatterbrained and emotional to realize it. Well, all right, I can play your games too, Miss Storm. And then she says, and I love that Kirby draws her look with her hand up to her cheek doing almost like a fashion pose. And she says, oh, go polish a test tube or something, which that's a great response.
Well, you know, but then the next panel sort of loses it for me because he says, that man, I know he's right. I was like, no, not necessarily. I was like, stick to your guns, girlfriend.
Yeah, that's a little strange. I love the body language in that panel, though, where she's sitting up on the bed. Like, Kirby, I don't think of Kirby as necessarily great at subtle body language or really anything subtle, but I kind of like the way she's got her foot up on the bed. It's kind of a nice pose. And then it reminds me later on page 19, where Doom is talking to the Terrible Trio. And at one point where he says, they're he's talking about the reward, and they say, "Oh, you're very generous." And he says, "More generous than you think." Doom is sitting on a chair with his feet up on the table. He's like super relaxed, Dr. Doom.
Relaxed back, yeah.
That looks great. Imagine sitting with that armor that probably weighs 500 pounds and just getting enough strength to put your legs up on the table. Imagine a clank, clank while he's doing that. He looks so relaxed. I love it. He looks like he's doing like a liquor ad or something. He's just sitting back. He's just like, it's okay.
The most famous man in the world.
Yeah, exactly. I love it. Absolutely love it. And then later on, the action sequence where the giant tube attacks Ben. I mean, it's like, I love the Kirby visual imagination here is really, really on display. I mean, in stories we'll get to in this very issue, I think Kirby's style develops even further, which I really like. But again, he's got just such a wonderful sense of imagination here. And then the dimension that Doom falls into, I love that it's like this, just this crazy world, and like the one point the floor is cut away and we see Doom falling into it, and it looks a bit like the other dimensions that Doctor Strange would visit over in Strange Tales. It has that same kind of phantasmagoria sort of feel to it. And then that last shot we see is of Doctor Doom just going, "Help!" as he just disappears. I love all that.
Well, and you know, it's funny, they had this big argument over leadership, and then we get one line at the end from Johnny that, "Well, I guess you can stay leader."
Yeah, yeah.
That was how we closed out our big thing. Well, you know, that'll work. We all squeeze through the window. We're all alive. I guess you can still lead us.
And you know, I think Ben says, "If you asked me, we should have elected Doom," which I think is a nice button. And then on the you've got the caption where it says, "Don't shed too many tears for old Dr. Doom, true believer. He survived and has returned myriad times to plague our four fearless foe fighters, and he's sure to pop up in a future issue when you least expect it." So I love that they're even like undercutting their own story on the very page. They're just like, "Don't worry about it. He'll be back. He's too popular for us to get rid of him for too long."
Yeah, and it's only issue 23 of the series.
Right, yeah. He's already, Stanley's already like, "Look, we all know Dr. Doom's coming back." So yeah, it's a fun, very goofy story. And again, there's so much plot. Again, I didn't even have really any room to mention the dinosaur running amok for three pages, which is like, that's how dense these stories are. That's how much crazy stuff goes on here. So in terms of it being a treasury, I don't know if this story is necessarily that great of a pick for a treasury edition, because there aren't, as you talked about earlier, like a lot of the big crazy machine things going on, which really kind of work well. This is more of a kind of a smaller story. There's a lot of smaller panels. The dinosaur sequence is probably actually the biggest action sequence of the whole thing, of where it's running amok and Sue captures it. But I mean, I think it's a fine story to work as a treasury, but it's maybe not one I would pick just because it's not Kirby as unleashed as we would get him later on.
Yeah. Well, you could have done his first appearance, but of course then we have the Sue as the captured hostage, which is, you know, he does that several times throughout the beginning of this series. It gets old. But, you know, hey, one time in the treasury wouldn't have been the end of the world. But it would have been nice because he has all kinds of doohickeys that he uses. You know, he goes up against them himself.
Right.
Which is nice. It's direct. And then there's one where he sets up all kinds of elaborate traps for them in this, like, I don't know, it was like an airplane or something. And that had a lot of interesting visuals to it that would have been nice, blown up. I think that we could have used one of those. But yeah, the dinosaur, that really sells this one. Otherwise, yeah, it's a story. It's there. That's about it.
Yeah, it's fine. So, all right, well, let's move on to the next story.
All right. The Coming of the Submariner, original issue number 4, May 1962. The Human Torch has quit the Fantastic Four and left her parts unknown. Mr. Fantastic blames the Thing, who picked a fight with the Torch last issue. Soon, the three remaining teammates separate to search the city for Johnny, each using their special abilities, sometimes with amusing results. It's the Thing who finds Johnny fixing cars with friends. Before he can teach Johnny who's boss once and for all, the Thing reverts to his human self, just long enough for the Human Torch to escape into the sky. Johnny decides to hide out in a men's shelter. While he's reading a comic of the old Submariner, the other guys try to get an old bum to show Johnny his strength, bugging him until a fight erupts. Johnny steps in, using his flame to take off the man's beard and trim his hair to reveal the Submariner.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, he has amnesia, so the Human Torch flies over the sea and drops him in. Within moments, the man remembers, hey, yeah, he is Namor the Submariner, and he eagerly swims homeward. Tragically, he finds his undersea kingdom destroyed from atomic bomb testing. He swears vengeance on the entire human race. Johnny sends up the Fantastic Four flare, and the others come running. The Submariner retrieves a shell trumpet horn that he uses to wake and control Giganto, a huge walking whale hybrid monster thing. Anyway, Giganto is attacking New York. The Fantastic Four swing into action, but not having much success, until the thing puts an atomic bomb on his back and walks it into Giganto's mouth, fighting off weird undersea creatures alive in the behemoth. The bomb does kill Giganto, but the Submariner gloats he's still got the horn to summon other monsters. The Invisible Girl grabs the horn and tries to run. Namor catches her and becomes enamored of her beauty, asking to become his bride. When he continues to threaten the surface world, Sue says she'll do anything if he'll spare the humanity, and Namor's rather insulted by this attitude. The Human Torch uses his flying ability to create a huge tornado which sweeps up Namor. In the howling winds, Namor loses his grip on the horn, and as the torch drops him into the sea, the horn is lost forever. Namor shakes his fist, swearing he'll be back. On the surface, Mr. Fantastic says the Submariner will find the Fantastic Four waiting for him.
Yeah, you did. You did such a good job at that. I should have had you read all the synopses. You really brought that to life, Laurel. That was fantastic. I love this story. I mean, this is, I grew up with this one. I don't even remember where I read it for the first time, but it has so many scenes that are just in my DNA as a comic book fan that it almost feels weird that I'm seeing this in, like, this is the actual story where this stuff is in it. You know what I mean? Like, I'm just so familiar with it. Especially the thing of in the flop house where Johnny burns off all the hair and he realizes that it's the Submariner. I mean, I feel like I've seen that image so many times. And again, it's just amazing to see the Submariner back and stuff like that. So, I mean, this is even earlier, obviously, in the FF's run. So it's, everything's even kind of even a little cruder. The Thing is more of the molten rock guy than the sort of blocky guy he would become. But I mean, it's, good Lord, it's just, these are themes in this story that Marvel writers would still be using 50 years later, 60 years later. It's just sort of amazing how much Stan Lee birthed into the Marvel Universe with just this one story and a bunch of concepts. So what did you think of it?
I like it. I like the Submariner. Namor, he just goes both ways. Sometimes he's good, sometimes he's bad, which I greatly like. One thing that's weird in this one, besides the Thing looking all, I don't know, like Mudman instead of Rocky, they keep calling him Thing. They never refer to him as Ben.
Mm.
I'm like, no wonder he has an anger issue, because nobody's bothering to call him they call each other by their names. But they don't call him that. Well, Thing, you did this, and why didn't you do that? And I was like, no wonder the man's angry. But I didn't get a chance, because I was trying to keep this thing short, to describe all the searching scenes. Because some of these, I listened to the Fantastic Cast ages ago when they covered this. And oh my gosh, it's like Sue goes into the soda shop, and she's drinking the soda when she's invisible for whatever reason. It freaks the guy out. And then we have Mr. Fantastic, like, snatching a guy off a motorcycle. Well, he's a teenager. He should know where Johnny is. It's just, they're doing crazy stuff like this. I thought they're just freaking out the populace of New York on their search.
This was in the early days of Fantastic Four. I feel like these were some themes that Stan Lee would basically adopt for the X-Men, where they were freaking people out. Like you mentioned, like Sue, there's no good reason why Sue is invisible in the malt shop, but she is. And all it is just freaking the guy out, because he sees the malt slowly disappear. And he's like, let me out of here. This place is haunted. And as you mentioned, where Reed grabs the guy. And back early on, they were sort of a little more like freaks, and they were scaring people. And I feel like eventually Stan would, of course, say, no, the Fantastic Four would become the kind of celebrities of the Marvel Universe, and then I would transpose those you know, kind of freak stories over to the X-Men, because that's what it feels like early in the very beginning. I do love the fact that the teenage biker that Reed grabs, he looks exactly like Marlon Brando from The Wild One. I just love that he's got the cap and the leather gun. It's exactly what he looks like. He's, what are you rebelling against? What do you got?
Didn't you ever wonder, where does the motorcycle go?
Yeah, it just disappears out of the frame. I guess it crashes off to the side or so. Hopefully it didn't hit anybody. I love that Johnny...
I hope so.
I love that Johnny is reading a Submariner comic, that in this universe, characters are in comic books, I don't know this for a fact. I mean, there's probably maybe some other examples, but I feel like that was that the first time anybody ever did that? I guess Flash did it, because in the Flash of Earth 2 was a comic book in Barry Allen's world. So I guess that he did it before Stanley. But I just love the idea that there are – that the Submariner is a real guy in this universe, and yet also in this world there is a comic book of him. And we even see – a kind of Kirby's version of a cover where it looks like the Submariner is punching a Nazi or something, which I just love. I think that's just such a fun idea.
Definitely. I think, Namor with his eyebrows, you know, the way there's high arched eyebrows, when he first comes back to shore after learning the city has been destroyed, and he's doing the perfect villain with the fist and the way his head's leaned back, ha ha, mwa, ha ha, he's doing his perfect villain pose there. I really enjoyed that. And Giganto. I mean, what a thing this is.
Yeah. This gigantic whale creature right out of like all the 50s monster comics they were doing. I just love that. I love he's got the giant mouth and something, and he's like stumbling kind of out of the water and stuff. And then just that one panel where they're firing at him. I mean, it's right out of every Godzilla movie. But I also love Namor's conch siren. That thing is
yes.
Great. That one thing, that is beautiful. It's so huge.
Yes, definitely. That was extremely humorous. And it's too bad it won't come back. I mean, I suppose it can. It's comic books. It could come back. But they're like, oh, it's lost forever. I'm like, oh, darn. I wonder what else it would have called up. That would have been kind of fun.
Yeah. Yeah. It's cool stuff. And this has, again, it's a lot of small panels. It's not Kirby, you know, fully unleashed, but nevertheless, there's some just really great stuff. I love Thing with the bomb strapped to his back. Like, that's just a great shot of him carrying the thing. And then he takes on this other monster, and it's just like, just in this one panel, and the monster's just like, ah, and things like, and here's one of them. It's unseen mine. And then the thing is punching him, and he's got like these pincers, and we see the thing like punching it off screen, which is great. And then the bomb explodes. I mean, just there's so much fun stuff going on. And then this monster, this Giganto, is basically dispatched in three panels on the final page. Nowadays, that would be half a book, getting rid of the monster. But in here, it's like Human Torch is like, all right, I'll just create this tornado. All right, Giganto's gone. That's it. That's the end. And we even have time for a little bit of an epilogue with the four Fantastic Four saying, I wonder what will happen to the Submariner.
Yeah. Yeah, I really like this one. This is one of my more favorite ones just because it introduces him. And, you know, we do get that little awestruck of her beauty bit, which at least later gets to be, oh, I like her spunk. I like her this, that, and the other thing. But this initial relationship, I was just like, oh, Lord. Oh, Beauty and the Beast. What happened here?
What do you think generally as that whole motif of Sue being slightly tempted by Namor? Does that seem plausible to you?
Yeah, actually it does. You know, there's always a place for the bad boy.
I know, it makes me so sad because I'm not a bad boy. I never have been. So, you know, but okay, I understand it. I can understand.
Yes, but you notice you marry the other one.
Well, I guess so. That's true. Yeah. I mean, she ends up, you know, having a baby with Reed and stuff. Yeah. She doesn't actually get with Namor. But yeah. And I can see, you know, Namor's a little, I mean, Reed's a little sensitive because, you know, Namor's always, first of all, he's built like a strong man where he comes out and he's in the little trunks and stuff like that. I did want to mention there is this one. I love the shot. It's on page 37 of the book where Namor comes out of the water and we just see the top of his head from like his eyebrows upward, and he says, but the human shall pay for this. I swear it. There's just something, I don't know, I find that very funny, just him just seeing the top of his head like that. And then when Johnny confronts him, and he says, what are you talking about? And Namor's got his fist up, and he's like, revenge! I'm talking about the revenge I shall have on the destruction of my undersea kingdom! And he's so happy. He just looks so delighted.
Yeah, that's the mwahaha moment to me.
He looks
great. That was it. It was like, oh, that was wonderful.
Yeah. I'm kind of amazed. This is a little off topic, but I'm amazed that the Mego Corporation never did a Submariner doll. Because they did Fantastic Four, and you would think Namor would have been cheap to produce because he doesn't have a very sophisticated – you give him that conch shell, you're done, you know? I mean, they already had the Spock doll. You could just kind of, like, refit that a little. I would just think it would be – he would have been so cheap to produce. I guess he wasn't very famous, which is why they never really did it because they really did stuff that you saw on the cartoon or whatever, although Namor – did appear in the 60s cartoon. But he seems like such a basic character. I'm kind of amazed that he didn't kind of make it onto more merchandise. I guess maybe because he's kind of unlikable, is that he's a good guy, but he's also a bad guy sometimes. So maybe that was the idea behind it. But I don't know. I always liked, even though I'm, of course, an Aquaman fan, I always liked Namor too.
Yeah. I like the regal ruler bit, that anti-hero side that he can have. And then on the other hand, he's just so not human.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good. It's a really fun story. And again, it just features so many iconic moments that it almost feels amazing. It's all boiled down into one story like this. Like, wow, this is where they did it. This is where it happened. So, all right, well, the next story is a Return of the Frightful Four by, again, of course, Lee and Kirby, this time inked by Joe Sinnott. It's from Fantastic Four number 94. Deciding to name their baby Franklin Benjamin Richards, honoring both Sue's father and Ben, Reed informs his friends that they are going to bring baby Franklin to a child-rearing expert named Agatha Harkness, who lives in a mansion on Whisper Hill. What the team is unaware of is that the Frightful Four has reunited and plans to attack during their visit with Agatha. That night, after introductions are made, the Fantastic Four retire for the night as guests of Agatha Harkness. When the Frightful Four break into the mansion, they incapacitate Ben in the torch, then trap Reed and Sue in their room. Planning to kidnap Franklin, they are first stopped by Medusa, who had only joined with the group to help protect the FF from them. However, she is bound by the Trapster's paste, but the Frightful Four are then defeated by Agatha and her cat, Ebony, unleashing her magical might and defeating each member with ease. When the Fantastic Four free themselves, they are shocked to find all the villains defeated. They find Agatha quietly rocking Franklin to sleep. When the Thing spies a book about the Salem witches, Agatha hints at the fact that she herself is truly a witch, which spooks Ben. So, what do you think of this one?
You can tell that it's much later.
Yes.
We went from, you know, issue 4 to issue 94, and it's like, woo, hello, big jump. Because the detail that's in the drawing here is more. There's more details. You know, you're getting all kinds of nice touches in the art that we weren't getting. I mean, Harkness's house has got these... Just the house itself, for one thing, was really cool. And then she's got all kinds of creepy stuff in her rooms and all this furniture. And we have, you know, the bad guys come in. There's just a lot going on visually that I really like that part.
The splash page is great. It's not a big action thing. It's just them cooing over the baby. But, you know, you mentioned you were complimentary about Kirby keeping up with Sue's hair. I mean, Sue in this panel, she kind of looks like that looks like a modern dress from the time. She kind of looks like Mia Farrow from Rosemary's Baby. And I'm like, that's Kirby keeping up with fashions of like the late 60s, which is like, again, good on him. She looks like a contemporary woman.
Yes. That was something that, like I said earlier, I appreciated that he kept up with it. And I feel like I know who his people are. I know, well, and Stan, of course, because he's the writer. I mean, I know who they are. Their personalities are a little bit more settled by this point. They've been, you know, 94 issues in. You'd think they'd have it by now. But this is the configuration that I like them the best. When Ben is not quite so angry all the time, he's only, you know, he has his moments kind of thing. The Human Torch flies off on things, but it's not the end of the world. There's a lot more thinking involved in these that I like better.
I love the opening sequence where they're talking to Ben and they're saying his middle name, of course, is Benjamin. And the Thing is wearing a suit and he goes, Benjamin, that's me. And the word balloon is so big, it's popping up out of the frame. Like, that's super adorable. And then he hugs the baby and he starts crying because he's so touched, which is really sweet. And I love, the little detail of baby Franklin is actually kind of like brushing his hands up against the Thing's face in that panel, which is really sweet because it's like the baby doesn't know enough to be afraid of the Thing. You know, it's like he's responding to Ben's kindness. I think that's a really nice detail. And then the very next page, sort of the complete opposite of this little cute baby moment. You talked about Kirby with his machinery. This machine that they are, the Frightful Four, is using to spy on the FF, it is enormously complicated. Like, it could just be a monitor, but instead, it's this crazy Rube Goldberg machine with all these, like, wires sticking out of it and tubes and all these transistors. And it's you know, sort of classic Kirby machinery. And, you know, boy, I kind of feel bad for Joe Sinnott that he had to ink all this, because he probably was like, really, Jack? You really had to make it this college? It's like, there's like little parts that are like squiggly and all sorts of, I mean, it's so much extra effort, but that's Kirby and his crazy machinery.
What I was curious about is I was surprised they didn't pick an issue where we weren't so mysterious about who Crystal and Medusa was.
Mm-hmm.
Because I thought if I was reading this collection as a kid, that would have driven me nuts. I'd want to know what was going on. Maybe that's why they chose it, because it would drive you nuts and you'd want to know. But this Agatha Harkness character, now, if I understand correctly, this is when she's introduced, right?
I believe so. This is her first appearance, yeah.
Because she's quite a character.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't tell if she was actually a witch or just hypnotizing people.
I like her quite a bit. I mean, again, she's right out of like an old gothic horror movie in the hotel, her mansion that she lives in. Again, is, you talked about the detail, there's all this amazing bric-a-brac, all this statuary of like gargoyles and stuff, and of course she's got the cat, and she has like this voodoo mask thing on the table, which Ben is looking at one point. And she's got an interesting visual, because she has these very deep set, like, she has little squinty eyes, but yet she is kind of like, they're almost like her eyelids are like almost half shut. She's just this kind of like permanent sleepy sort of visage, which I think is kind of an interesting take on it. And then, of course, you get, when the Frightful Four attacks, then you've got even more of the bizarre designs. I mean, you've got the wizard and the giant bullet head that he's got, which is weird. And then the Sandman in his sort of mod costume. And yeah, you're right. You mentioned that this thing features Medusa and Crystal, and it never really explains who either one of them are. You just have to kind of figure it. And which is, you know, it's not like you could go back and buy old issues of the Fantastic Four at this time, because, I mean, you know, back in that time, the stuff was off the stands, it was gone forever. But yeah, I mean, it would have been interesting if maybe they had done a story introducing the Inhumans or something like that. But yeah, you just have to kind of go along with it. And I love Medusa using her powers, where she's grabs the wizard with her hair and throws him around. Like, that is just, I love Kirby's whole thing on that. I think that's such a great sequence.
The Medusa as a character, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, all the Inhumans are very interesting.
I love the Inhumans. I really do.
Yeah, yeah. The part that I was looking at was that they were fighting in their street clothes.
Right.
Which we don't see that a lot. Usually they're in their outfits no matter what's going on, or they suddenly transform into their outfits. So it was neat to see the Fantastic Four literally running around in their civvies the whole issue.
Yeah, Reed's in his undershirt, and mm-hmm. Sue's in her robe, which is fun. And then the sequence I love the most, and like I talked about earlier, I had a tough time with Kirby when I was younger, and now I really appreciate it. But when the wizard goes after Agatha Harkness, and she sicks Ebony the cat, and we see that Ebony grows from a regular cat to basically like a raging panther. He's like, but Ebony is far, far more than just an alley cat, and it turns into this savage-looking creature. It's a beautiful sequence. I'm going to put it up on the website, fireandwaterpodcast.com, so you can take a look at it on the gallery post. I love how Ebony gets closer and closer and closer. And then in that panel where it attacks the wizard, he just turns into like a silhouette. It's mm-hmm. really an intense sequence. It's kind of almost like a horror sequence, but you don't generally think of Kirby doing that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yes. I totally get what you're saying. I personally, the trick that I like the best, and this is why I wondered if it was hypnotism, is when she makes the Sandman think he's turning to stone.
That's really
And she's
cool
like
too.
Waving her arm. Yeah. She's waving her arm in the air. And I thought, what is she doing? She hypnotizing him. And then suddenly it's almost like he's becoming the thing, only he can't move.
Mm-hmm.
And then they find him and he's stiff as a board for no apparent reason. You know, it's whatever was going on in his mind made him act that way. That just to me was very interesting how she took care of him.
I love that when that happens, Pastebot Pete is like, have to get away, have to escape. All of a sudden, the world's gone crazy. And he just runs, he just tries to run away. I love that. It's like he's living up to his lame ass name, where he's just like, I'm out of here. Forget it. And then, of course, he gets caught by Ebony.
Do you think the demon thingy that he's looking at, does that not remind you of Mike Mignola? and his monsters.
Yes. Yes.
Do you know? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. The big thing where it's got its big mouth open. Yeah, that's.
Yeah, I was like, I wonder if that's where he got that kind of stuff from.
It wouldn't surprise me at all. It does look a lot like that. And I love the lighting, too. The one point where he's, like, bathed in just this magenta light, where he's like, it's too big, not even – I love this. It's too big, not even my paste gun could stop it. Oh, well, if your paste gun can't stop it, then it just must be – it might as well just be Galactus level, Pete. If your paste gun is – it's too much for your paste gun. But he really thinks a lot of himself, for God's sakes. But it's – and then Sandman gets turned back, and you mentioned that he then it becomes immobile. He just turns into a statue, which is fun. And then in the final sequence, as you said, there everybody's in their normal clothes. And then I love it when Ben is thinking about Agatha Harkness, and she says, you're looking at me so strangely. One would almost think that if I were a witch – and Ben goes, aw, who'd ever imagine such a thing as nutty as that? And there's this great shot of him where his eyes are super wide. And the final panel is him just running the hell out of Agatha Harkness' house. It's such a great comedy beat way to end the story.
Yeah, I like it when he's in this kind of a mood. Because he's our, like, grounded character in a way. Even though he's, okay, he can punch things and he can take a lot of weight and all that kind of stuff. But on the other hand, he's sort of like the average Joe mm-hmm. character. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have all this highfalutin names and all this stuff going on. No, it's show me something and I'll clobber it. And otherwise, he's got the, you know, the kind of wide-eyed, take it as it comes attitude. So that makes it fun.
It really is a really, really fun story. I don't think I'd ever – I guess probably I had read it at some point. I'm not sure, but it was really fun. And again, like, it's big. You got the Kirby machinery and stuff like that. And so I actually think it's – aside from Medusa and Crystal being introduced and we don't know who they are, it's actually – I think it's a really good pick as a Treasury story. Now, the final story, though, is – well, why don't we talk about it? Because the final one is just a stone-cold classic.
Yeah, this is my favorite of the group we're doing. This Man, This Monster. And this is from issue 51 of June 1966. A despondent thing is wandering the city in the pouring rain when he's invited inside a man's apartment for a cup of coffee. Only this coffee is laced with sedatives. When the thing falls unconscious, the man reveals he's actually a scientist who used his short-range subliminal influencer to draw the thing to him. The scientist believes he is the mental superior of Reed Richards and will prove it by destroying the Fantastic Four. To this end, he uses his duplication apparatus to draw off the thing's power to become the thing himself, leaving a now-human Ben Grimm behind. The scientist thing returns to FF headquarters, but his performance is interrupted when the real Ben Grimm shows up claiming, hey, scientist thing is a fake. Reed and Sue don't believe Ben, and he stomps away in anger. In the lab, Reed prepares his experiment. He must enter his radical cube, which will create an entrance into subspace. Subspace is the key to faster-than-light travel, which could help humanity against threats like Galactus. While he's inside subspace, only the thing will have the strength to haul him back out by a tether Reed has attached to his belt. Meanwhile, Johnny has begun college and is enjoying coffee with his roommate Wyatt Wingfoot at the cozy campus coffee shop when he's harassed by star football player Whitey Mullins. A fight looks likely when the argument is broken up by Whitey's football coach. Whitey leaves in a huff. The coach discovers that Wyatt is the son of Will Wingfoot, an Olympic decathlon star. He wants Wyatt on the football team, but Wyatt's not interested. Still, when the coach returns to his wife's table, he tells her he must get Wyatt to play. Back at Reed's lab, Reeb enters the machine over Sue's frantic objections. He plunges through the void, past the space-time dimensional barrier, traveling to the edge of subspace to the crossroads of infinity. Unfortunately, every form of matter seems to be pulling itself to one central point, Earth. Except in subspace, all matter is negative and will explode when it comes into contact with the positive atmosphere of Earth, including Reed and the rock he's standing on. Reed tugs on the tether, but the scientist thing hesitates. As Sue begs him to pull Reed back, he realizes his failure really was his own fault and not caused by the brave, unselfish Reed. So by the time he gets out of his own head and decides to save Reed, the taunt line snaps. Desperately, he charges into the device to dive on the end of the tether, only now he's too, being pulled into the subspace, ending up on the broken rock next to Reed, who is terribly upset that, quote-unquote, Ben will now die with him. Regretting his previous jealousy, the scientist then grabs Reed and with all his strength tosses him back the way they came. Then he settles onto the rock, awaiting the inevitable. At that moment, back on Earth, the now human Ben Grimm decides to pay a visit to Alicia, feeling that, as a man, he can now compete for her affections. As he knocks on her door, his hand, his body, transforms back into the thing, and he runs away. In the lab, Reed flies out of the machine onto the floor at Sue's feet. As the two begin to grieve for the lost thing, the real thing returns. While Sue and Reed are overjoyed, Reed laments for the lost scientist. We'll never know what monstrous thing he had done in the past, or what monstrous plans he had made, but one thing is certain. He paid the full price, and he paid it like a man.
Wow. I remember a bunch of years ago, I don't remember the context, but there was an article I read online, and it was to commemorate some anniversary, either regarding Kirby or the Fantastic Four, and whoever was doing it asked a bunch of comic creators, name your favorite Fantastic Four story. And I think about a full third of them listed this one. This is just the Stone Cold classic. And the fact that it came after the Galactus saga, which was this multi-part thing, and then Stan Lee would change it up and do this one-off character piece, even with all the action, it really does kind of underscore that Lee and Kirby deserved all the plaudits that they got, because nobody was really doing comics like this in 1965. I mean, this is just unreal, the level of sort of characterization and sophistication he was bringing to it. So, I mean, I think this is just yes, this story's been reprinted maybe a few too many times at this point, but in 1976, if you were putting together a great collection of Fantastic Four stories, this one, yeah, it has to be in there. I mean, what do you think of it?
Oh, yeah, this was my favorite of the ones that were in here.
Yeah.
Simply because, well, we've got this sort of ongoing soap opera, which over time, that got to be really well developed, where the thing, here he is completely dejected. And it's because he's, having, no luck in love kind of thing. I'm an ugly, and he's going on like that as if he's the monster. And then you turn around and have this science guy who's has this major plot against Reed, and like the title says, it makes you wonder who is the man and who is the monster. I mean, you really got to sit back and think about it for a moment, because this guy was planning some serious harm.
You talk about the Kirby machinery, and on page 75 of this book is one of the ultimate Kirby machines, which is the Radical Cube, which is simultaneously kind of this sci-fi futurism with a kind of Salvador Dali, Pablo Picasso, weird surrealism. I mean, only Jack Kirby could fuse those two things. This machine is just, I mean, good Lord, I don't even know where you would even walk into this thing. It looks like it has a kind of eye at the top, kind of, and it has these weird curves that no machine would really have, and yet it looks also futuristic and sophisticated. It's just one of the great Kirby machines, I would say.
He's got a couple of them in here, and this is what I thought we'd get more of in this collection, because, I mean, this guy opens the closet, the scientist guy, because he's never given a name in here, and there's this whole big apparatus in there, and he's just, he's got this inducer to make the thing come to him, that was like, okay, and those kind of little pieces that I thought would be scattered more throughout. I mean, Reed's putting on this complicated outfit initially with all these doodads, and that was fun. And then you have the whole trippy experience of him going through to get to this subspace thing. That was a couple pages of wild.
Yeah, and it's just crazy how much visual life he was bringing to all this. And, I mean, we didn't even mention the splash page, one of the most iconic images in all of Marvel Comics, which is the thing standing there and the rain is pouring on him. It's like film noir with a giant rock monster. I mean, again, it's two things that wouldn't normally fit together. We should mention this was inked also by Joe Sinnott, who was also one of Kirby's finest inkers. He really brought such a polish to Jack Kirby's kind of wild pencils and kind of reined it in a little bit. Again, the machines are great. I love it when the thing has that that big tube and he smashes it between his two fingers and it just crunches into like a, he just smashes it like it's paper. I just love all that because it's just the way the thing is able to reduce this incredibly complex metal thing into just a bunch of trash. The scene, as you mentioned, of the Reed going into subspace reminds me very much of 2001. Space Odyssey. This is before that too, but the shots of him floating in this red remind me of Bowman in the brains of Hal as he's trying to turn the machine off. It has that kind of feel to it. Though I don't know the who chose the color, the lighting. I'm assuming it was the colorist, but I don't know whether maybe Kirby spec'd that. There's no, the colorist is not credited here in this story, but I mean, I love that whole bit. I'm just kind of the colors of that. And then it ends on this wonderfully human moment where he goes to visit Alicia. And in the last second, his powers, he goes back to being the thing and he runs out, which is a great moment. It really is. It's just one of those stories you're like, man, I could see why Marvel Comics made such a splash at this time, because this is just so far ahead of what most people were doing. It's wonderful. And I love that panel of Sue hugging Ben. Oh, Ben, dearest, we thought we had lost you. It's so sweet because she's got her cheek up against him. I love that even though he's this rock guy, she just, they have that warmth towards him. It's just, it's really so beautiful.
I was very moved by the process with which this science guy works his way out through his head to figure out that he is the one in the wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate that, that real character development we got, and the moment when he picks him up and tosses him and then he sits alone on the rock and you're just, you know what's going to happen next. That really got me, because like they were saying at the end, he paid in full measure, and it's like, I don't know, far, far better thing that I do kind of thing. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's what got me.
I guess I'm luckier than most. I got that chance, for I finally learned what it means to have a friend. Yeah, it's really amazing. Amazing stuff. I am kind of curious as to why these four stories are run out of order. Because obviously we just talked about Fantastic Four 94, and now this is 51. And then, of course, in the beginning of the book, it starts with 23 and then goes back to 4. I'm guessing that maybe they wanted a Dr. Doom story to lead the book off. And then maybe they realized that this man, this monster is, probably by a good fathom, fair fathoms, the best story in the book. And so we're like, let's go out on a high note. Let's go out on the big one. Because, otherwise they're kind of running them out of order. Not that it matters. These are four relatively disconnected stories. But I just thought it was interesting is that they're kind of bopping around. But maybe they figured, let's end on the best one because it is. It's such a famous story.
Do you think this collection would have worked better with a theme?
It's funny. I mean, the cover talks about that it says in battle with their most fearsome foes, which makes you think. And the back cover has this shot of the four standing there. And then there's inset shots of Dr. Doom, Medusa, Submariner, Paste Pot Pete, Wizard, and Sandman, as if, that's kind of what the theme of it is. But it isn't really, because this man, this monster, isn't a villain story. You've got the Frightful Four and whatever, and Submariner is, I guess, one of their villains. He kind of toggled back and forth. But yeah, maybe if they had dropped, which is funny. I wouldn't want to drop this man, this monster, because it's the best story. But yeah, maybe if they had focused on maybe just introduction of four of their big villains or something. But yeah, I don't know. This one seems a little more, this is just a great collection of Fantastic Four stories.
Yeah. So it's just a little all over the place, which is why I was wondering, would we have done better with a theme, the Fantastic Four meet everybody in the Marvel Universe. I mean, they do that within the first 60 issues.
Yeah,
you know?
That's true. That's true.
They could have done that. And so, or like you said, if it's supposed to be their villains, then this story doesn't really fit, even though I would hate to have this story not be here. This needs to be here. This is my favorite story of the bunch.
Yeah, and it also could be just a pragmatic decision is that they had page counts. They had to worry about it. Because this book, other than the inside back cover, which features a a nice drawing of Stan, who presumably drawn by Marie Severin. I think it tended to be these portraits of the staff tended to be by Marie Severin. And he says, "Rallying round my head are the original covers to the stories printed herein. Consider them a batty bonus from your bashful bullpen. Excelsior!" Other than the inside cover, there's really no extras in this book. There's no pinups. There's no bonus features. There's no puzzles or games. It really is just the four stories. So it may have been that, you know, part of it is, well, okay, we have to fit, you know, we have a page count that we have to, meet. And so, therefore, we're limited to what stories we can run. But, yeah, it is kind of a little bit all-over collection. I already, we did an episode of Treasury Cast on the other Fantastic Four collection. Actually, there's another one even after this. But we did the first one, me and Kyle Benning, and that one is almost, I think it's entirely devoted to the Galactus saga, which is making it kind of an early trade paperback. So that one has a little more of a theme, but this is just, I guess, you know, hey, Fantastic Four is one of our big titles, so let's just do some, you know, like reprint some classic stories that you may not have read. So, I mean, yeah, theme-wise, it doesn't hang together, but otherwise, and visually, I really like it because, again, it's all Kirby and it's just super fun.
Yeah, I agree. I enjoyed this one. Like I said, just a little bit more eclectic than I might have preferred. But on the other hand, you know, it's Fantastic Four. It's a lot of fun. You get to see the development of the characters because they're such big jumps between issues. So
right.
You get the development. You get to see, oh, things have changed. You know, what's going on now? That kind of thing.
Yeah, it's a really solid book, and Marvel was really good at this. They knew kind of what to pull together out of their files, and I've always said, but I think it would have been a fun job to like go through the archives and decide these stories and figure out what we could run. And then, of course, you're commissioning the new covers and stuff because they said the back cover and the front cover are all new. So it's a really, really solid book, and I'm really glad we had a chance to talk about it. Laurel, thank you so much for coming on. This was so awesome. We've been online friends for years, and I love it when I finally have a chance to talk to someone like that and at length. So this was awesome. Thank you for doing this.
I have to thank you for having me on and trying to send me the book and then having to send me the scans because I couldn't read the book. And we had all kinds of chaos behind the scenes. So, Rob, you made this possible, and I thank you deeply for it.
It was all worth it. I'm really glad to have you on. So where can people find you on the internet?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at MountainFlower1. That's without the vowels, MountainFlower1. And then podcasting-wise, I'm on the Huntress, Helena Bertinelli podcast, and the Birds of Prey, Feathers and Foes podcast. Those are on the Right On Network with Ashford Wright. And so you can find me on any of those. They're on iTunes if you want to look for them.
Very cool. And we'll have a link to your Twitter feed on in the show notes. So you can go right to there and follow Laurel on Twitter, which I do from my 19 different accounts. So again, thank you so much for coming on, Laurel. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We want you to stay tuned for some podcast promos. And when I come back, I'm going to do some listener feedback.
To confront the ultimate killers, I must construct the ultimate alias.
Ah! Hey, who is that lady? I think she could fly.
To combat the murderers who destroy my family, crush my own life on their way to consuming everything, I must become a greater, more fearsome destroyer.
Ah! Ah, no! Hey man, somebody killed this lady.
To track down the animals who prey on the innocent, I must stalk them first. I am no longer their quarry. I am the Huntress.
New Huntress podcast coming to you in 2019. Visit thehuntress89.blogspot.com for new episodes. Go to the Facebook page at Huntress Podcast. Go to Twitter, The Huntress Podcast. And you can always find episodes of The Huntress Podcast at rightonnetwork.com. And go to Apple iTunes, where this podcast is a joint venture with the Helena Bertinelli podcast and the Cassandra Cain Batgirl podcast. So go to Apple Podcasts, the Batgirl/Huntress podcast.
The Fantasticast is your guide to the Fantastic Four from the beginning of the Marvel Age of Comics in 1961 onwards.
Each week, Steve Lacy and Andy Leyland cover every issue, spin-off, guest appearance and cameo, and more.
And in 2015, we begin our journey through the decade that tastes forgot, the 1970s.
Join us as we take a look at
the departure of Jack Kirby and Stan Lee,
the Kree-Skrull War,
the arrival of Marvel Team-Up,
Bill Murray as the Human Torch.
Creators including Roy Thomas, George Perez, Marv Wolfman, Jerry Conway, Rich Buckler and John Byrne.
And of course, Marvel 2-in-1.
All this and more at ffcast.libsyn.com and on iTunes and Stitcher.
The Fantastic Cast.
Insert catchy tagline here. Wait, what?
It's time for listener feedback, and we are covering the feedback we got for episode 37 of the show, which was Captain America's Bicentennial Battles with John Wilson and Michael Kaiser from Make Ours Marvel. From the website, fireandwaterpodcast.com, first up is our pal, Ido Boznar. He says, oh yeah, back in 1976, having just turned 8, I really loved this book. A lot of it flew over my head, but I loved it nonetheless, and that's despite the fact that I mostly didn't like Kirby's art at that point. There was something about the story that just captivated me. Haven't read it since, though, so I'm not sure what I would think of it now, particularly because, as noted, at the age of 8, I hardly understood the general malaise in America in the wake of Vietnam and the Watergate scandal. I do vividly recall all the bicentennial hype, though. Based on your descriptions, it seems apparent that Kirby very much had all of this in his mind when putting together the story. By the way, the Captain America annual you mentioned is number 6, which came out in the early 80s. I recall liking it quite a bit, in part because it reminded me of Bicentennial Battles. As usual, wonderful show, gentlemen. Thank you, Ado. Ryan Daly from our network says, what do kids know of history? September 2008, a few weeks before Barack Obama was elected, a high school freshman asked me, was JFK the first black president? I scrunched up my face in disbelief and said, what? No, we haven't had a black president of the United States before, and JFK was white. The freshman responded, but I thought he was MLK's brother. I am no longer a high school teacher. I love that story, Ryan. Thank you. Kind of continuing on that thread, Chuck Galletta says, I think the biggest problems with kids today is we live in a fragmented culture with few shared experiences. TV is no longer a communal experience. The other problem is self-absorption. Why are so many kids taking pictures of themselves? Few can handle constructive criticism, and they seem conditioned never to be challenged or to feel uncomfortable at any time. End of rant. I need to go chase some kids off my lawn. Let me know how that goes, Chuck. Matt Sirose says, Mr. Buddha continues to make appearances. He's now known as the Contemplator. Of course he is. As previously mentioned, he united William Naslin, Jeff Mace, William Burnside, and Steve Rogers in Captain America Annual 6 and created the Captain America Corps in a miniseries of the same name. Basically, his theme is to bring together Captain Americas from various time periods and realities to save other realities where America has fallen to despots. The colonial era Cap made his appearance in Mark Waid's short-lived Captain America Sentinel of Liberty number 7, and the Western Cap had an entry in Marvel Westerns The Outlaw Files, implying that the Captain from Texas may have existed as well. Thank you so much for the information, Matt. Gothos Mansion says, while I can understand that the Treasury may be too episodic for some readers, having Cap dropped in so many time frames keeps the plot moving. Even with 70-plus pages to fill, Kirby never lets the action lag. I don't think Kirby ever committed the cardinal sin of letting a comic get boring. That is very true. If Kirby had a weakness as a storyteller, and he didn't, it was that he was too creative. How many times have you read a Kirby story and saw some character or gadget that he treated as a throwaway that only lasted for a page or two and thought, I want more of that? Not just here, but I enjoy Kirby's work and any Treasury because it looks more spectacular at the bigger size. I'm going to admit that my fondness for this may be childhood nostalgia. I didn't get this particular Treasury until I was an adult, and I first discovered Cap in an Invaders issue, which was a 3-pack. The first issue of the Captain America I got was Kirby's action-packed last issue, also in a 3-pack. Kirby's action-oriented Cap was much more fun than the mopey Cap I encountered on his Power Record. I always loved the wild weirdness of Kirby's Cap. Another part of my enjoyment of 70s Kirby. If you ever got those old comics collections in the Christmas catalog, they always had a few 70s Kirbys in them. I guess because they had fallen out of popularity at the time, I enjoyed all of them. Thank you, Gothos. Yeah, Cap is pretty mopey in the Power Record, which Chris Franklin and I covered over on the Power Records podcast. It is a kind of a interesting choice for a Power Record, since it was aimed at children, and yet that one is kind of so internal. You would think they would have maybe done a more a Kirby Cap because it is, as you say, so much slam-bang action. And I'm glad you mentioned the comic 3-packs. That's like a little weird little corner of comics the comics world that I would love to cover someday. I don't really have much information on them. I own a few of them, and they're kind of expensive to get nowadays. But I would love to do a podcast on those, because those were, you know, growing up, they were a big part of it, was the comic three packs, and it's something that that continued on, I think, up into like the 90s at Toys R Us and places like that. So it was still a thing up until fairly recently. So anyway, thank you for the comment. Ward Hill Terry says, as an American kid who turned 12 in the summer of 76, I can vividly remember all the patriotic promotion, both genuine and blatantly commercial. I disagree with Rob about this book being for collectors. This was aimed at non-comics reading public. It would have been for sale in an enormous variety of places, i.e. grocery stores, drug stores, variety stores, etc. The story does not reference any other Marvel property. The reader who was attracted to the flag festooned figure of Captain America on the cover could read the story without having to know who the Avengers, Sam Wilson, the Carter sisters, Nick Fury, or Batroc were. I haven't read this one myself, but I ask you all, could this book serve as an introduction to comic book literacy? Are Kirby's layouts and figures clear as to intention? I expect so. It's an interesting idea, Ward. Yeah, I mean, that's true. This Cap story does kind of exist completely by itself, except for the reference to Bucky. And then they do give context that Bucky was his late partner. So yeah, maybe so. And you're right. I mean, I guess when I said it was aimed at collectors, I didn't mean that specifically, because, you know, comics were still on sale, mostly at newsstands at that point. So, yeah, everything was meant for everybody. And of course, yeah, tying it into the bicentennial meant Marvel was trying to pick up some of that bicentennial heat that was going on in 1976, just like DC was trying to do with their Superman Salutes the Bicentennial comic, which, again, we covered. Chris Franklin, my pal from the Power Records podcast, which I just mentioned, and Superman Movie Minute from our network, says, I think this is another treasury I had read during my comic shop clerk days. I would love to have this one, as I love Kirby's Cap. I have almost the complete run of his 70s return to the book. It's nuts, but it's so energetic and fun. I think perhaps we aren't giving modern kids enough credit. Sure, there are some kids who have no idea or of even the vaguest semblance of American history. But I went to school with kids like that too. My daughter is a fan of the Who Was series of books and the accompanying Netflix series. These are mini bios, documentaries aimed squarely at kids. Sure, they are funny and irreverent in a lot of ways, but all the facts are there. If Marvel could pay Chris Evans or Anthony Mackie some dough to do some historical time travel segments like this on Disney Plus or something, it could really turn kids on to learning actual history. Not sure you could get them to read a comic, but the characters could still work as that gateway. Great show. Chris, I love that idea to have these on Disney Plus, these little interstitials of having Captain America or the Falcon or pretty much any of the Marvel characters like a more you know kind of thing. I mean, I love this idea, but I'm kind of expanding it in my mind. I was like, you could have, Iron Man do science, or Shuri from Black Panther do science stuff. I mean, you could teach, have Spider-Man teach about like insects. I mean, do like these little 30-second things. That would be marvelous. But I love that idea, Chris. That's great. Boy, we have to like get that in front of somebody at Disney Plus. I think that is a superb idea. Thank you for sharing that. And then finally, Liz Ann Oswald says, Kirby's art is in class by itself. He was a great artist and great at coming up with new characters. This looks like a fun comic, and I'm glad they celebrated the bicentennial. Yeah, he is in a class by himself. I mean, he is the single greatest comic book creator of all time. I don't think that's a particularly controversial statement. So again, thanks everybody for the comments. I really appreciate it. That was a super fun episode to do with the Make Ours Marvel guys. As I said on that episode, I'm a mega fan of that show, and I was really very pleased that they would come and do my show with me. So finally, I have to thank everybody who retweeted the show over on Twitter. It helps get the show noticed. So big thanks to TK Hulk 2, Oswald Liz, hey, Warlord Worlds, Make Ours Marvel, Beirut Wedding, El Jacone, Once Upon a Geek, JLI Podcast, Firestorm Fan, Coffee Comics Blog, Dallin B, Tim Price 17, It's Plastic Man, Factory Mirror, Max Over Mirror, Ryan Daly 1, Scott Slangward, Mountain Flower 1, hey, Kaiser the Great, Comic Book Lord 81, Dr. Pop Culture BG, BTB Blog, Comics in the Golden Age, Dark Long Box, Into the Weird, Comic Reflection, Greybeard the Grim, Russell Rosen K1, Kyle Benning Art, DC ONS Retreat, Storm Chaser 2162, Billy Delicious, Dob Creative, and Siskoid. Again, thanks all everybody for those retweets. I really appreciate it. I love getting the show out there as much as possible. So again, thank you for that. Thank you for all the comments, and a big thank you to Laurel for coming on the show and talking about the Fantastic Four. That was a whole ton of fun. We've been talking about doing the show for a long time, and I'm glad we finally got a chance to do it. So that is going to do it for this episode of Treasure Cast. As usual, you can leave comments on the website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can go to Twitter, and we're always talking treasures over there at Treasury Comics. So thanks everybody for listening, and until the next episode, go big or go home.
It was the world's strangest accident. While testing a new rocket ship, our heroes were bombarded by mysterious cosmic rays from outer space. Though they crash-landed safely, the strange and powerful rays had changed each one of them, transforming their leader, Reed Richards, into the plastic-skinned Mr. Fantastic. Sue Richards into the Now You See Her, Now You Don't, Invisible Girl. And Ben Grimm into a mighty muscled powerhouse called The Thing. Now together with Herbie the Robot, the newest member of the group, they have become the greatest team of superheroes the world has ever known. The new Fantastic Four.